Well, here we are again, back in the book of Genesis. You remember, if you've been here each Sunday, that we started with the creation of the world, the creation of the human being. Then we moved on to the establishment of a people for God's praise with the call of Abraham and Sarah and Abraham's gifting of a child. Today, the narrative lectionary, which Manningham Uniting is following, moves us on to another of the great patriarchs. And we heard this morning the story of, do you remember? What was the story? Who was in the story this morning? Jacob. Oh, good. You were listening. Now, this is a great saga. In preparation for this, it's not a great feat, but I actually read the whole book of Genesis through like a novel. And it's interesting. It could be a script for a soap opera. I recommend it to you. Read the whole of Genesis just like you'd read a short story. It's very enlightening. And probably some of you will have some residual memory of the story of Jacob. But just to get you into the story and to make sure you've got the facts straight, we're going to have a little Bible quiz now. If you know the answer, just call it out. Sorry, there are no minties, but just call it out. Who was Isaac again? No? Yeah. He was renamed Israel. Who was Isaac? Abraham and Sarah's son. The miraculous one. The one born when it was not possible to be born. And Isaac got married, as people generally do. What was Isaac's wife's name? Rebecca. Very good. And who were Isaac and Rebecca's children? Other way round. Esau and Jacob, because Esau was the first. As an oldest child, you know, position's important. Esau is first born, but Jacob is the second born. Twins. Yes, remember? Twins. Esau was born first, the story goes. Jacob was born hanging on to Isaiah's foot as he came out of the womb. But Jacob was always the one who was top dog. Do you remember what the character of Esau and Jacob were? What was Esau good at? What was his character? He was a hunter. Yes. And Jacob? Do you remember what his nickname was? It wasn't Jack either. His nickname was the Deceiver. Esau was the hunter. Jacob was the clever man. He was the one who worked out the angles. He was the one who knew how to get on in the world. So that's the family, folks. Just introducing them to you so that you can follow the story. This is going to be a bit of a saga itself, but stay with me. When they were growing up, Jacob, looking for the right chance, cheats Esau, his older brother, out of his birthright. As the firstborn, Esau had the right to have the blessing of his father to carry on the line. But Jacob cheated Esau out of that. Firstly, by making Esau promise to give the birthright to Jacob. You remember how he did that? Jacob was cooking in the kitchen and he cooking up a very nice meal, and Esau comes in from hunting, says, "Oh, I'm famished, I'm dying for something to eat." And Jacob said, "I'll give you some of this if you'll give me the birthright." Esau said, "Oh, I'm dying for a hunting to eat. Yeah, you can have it." First trick to Jacob. Then later, with his mother's connivance, with Rebecca's connivance, Jacob cheats Esau out of his birthright by pretending to blind old Isaac that he's Esau. And it's interesting to see how mother and son work that one. The result is that Esau has a great resentment against Jacob and says, I'm going to kill you one day. Many years passed. The feud still goes on between these two twins. But the day of reckoning comes, as days of reckoning do. And Jacob, who has since married himself, another interesting story, a soap opera in itself, he is married, built up a big, has wives and, the Bible says, has wives and concubines and lots of stuff. Esau himself too has prospered, and he has amassed himself a fortune, plus a little army. So Jacob is heading back home, hoping for some kind of reconciliation with Esau. But because he's heard that Esau's coming to get him, and he's got 400 bouncers, 400 men of arms with him, so you can see, he quickly gathers that Esau isn't coming to find Jacob so they can play happy families, are they? But Jacob, again, ever the deceiver, ever the looking for the main chance man, tries to get to some kind of truce with Esau. So he sends all of his entourage on ahead of him. First of all, he sends Esau a whole bag of stuff, gifts, all thinking that he'll impress Esau and win him over. And then he sends his entourage on ahead of him so he can go and confront Esau by himself without any danger to his wives and children and all the rest. And he camps that night, and this is where we pick up the story in the reading this morning, by the river Jabbok. And he goes to sleep. But during the night, he encounters a stranger. And they wrestle all through the night. It's almost an even match. Neither one could overcome the other. And as dawn is breaking and the light is coming, the stranger, who wants to preserve his hiddenness, seeks to end the engagement. And there are three crucial exchanges between the stranger, who's never named, and Jacob. Are you still with me? This is awfully convoluted, isn't it? Are you following? Nod, or something, yes. Okay, they're wrestling, and the stranger says to Jacob, let me go. Dawn is breaking, the light is coming. Jacob says, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Jacob was always out for the blessing. The stranger says, what is your name? Jacob says, Jacob. The stranger says, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, because you have wrestled with God and humans and prevailed. What is your name? Jacob says to the stranger. And the stranger says, why do you want to know my name? The stranger only prevails over Jacob when he does some kind of secret jiu-jitsu thing and touches him on the hip joint and throws his leg out. And then he blesses Jacob and departs. Now, this is some story. It's worth reading, really. Now, if we take a pause here, that's the story. I've taken a long time to retell it because we think we know it, but there are some things there that are really important for us today. What do we learn from this exchange between our ancient ancestor, our ancestor in faith, and who God is? We need to see first that if the stranger really was God in human form wrestling with Jacob, we see that it was not just a private experience. It's also about God's people in every age and their struggle with God. One commentator, one scholar, says that such stories of the past are about us in an earlier embodiment. We are Israel. We have lessons to learn as God wrestles with us and we struggle with God. The things to note in the story. Jacob wanted to know the name of God because to know the person's name was to have control over them in that time period. If someone gave you the name, they were giving you themselves. So Jacob wants to know the name of the stranger so that he can have some control over God. We modern human beings do the same thing in a different way. We want to name God. We want a God who is like us. We want a God that we can understand, a God who is amenable to what we want gods to do. We want to define who God is so we have a God amenable to our private desires, a God who will bless our battleships, who will bless our soldiers, our arms over against any enemy that we name and choose. But what we learn from this story is that God is not the God of Israel. The God of Jesus is not like that kind of God. That God is not an idol that we create, name, and give attributes to. God remains the hidden one, the inscrutable mystery. And that, my friends, is the blessing. We don't have a God who belongs to our country, our nation, our people, our values. We learn that God is not a servant of ours whom we can command and expect to do our bidding. And that's a new thought for many people today. The second thing we note is in his struggle with God, Jacob is given a new name, Israel. It means perhaps God preserves or God protects. In his encounter with God, Jacob the deceiver, Jacob the conniver, Jacob the clever one, is renamed. He's born again, as it were. New possibilities are opened up for him because in the giving of the blessing, something of the power of God has been entrusted to this man, Israel. God has struggled with humanity in Jesus Christ and given us a new name too, Christian. And we preserve that element of this story in the old practice of when a person was baptized, they were given a baptismal name to signify this new relationship, this new personhood, that they are not only now the child of their parents, they are always so named by God. That's the meaning of your Christian name, although in our multicultural, multi-faith society, we no longer use as commonly Christian name. It's first name, family name. But we are renamed in our baptism, incorporated into the faith of Jesus, and and the power of the Spirit that is gifted to us. That's the significance of our baptism, which goes right back to this story in Jacob. So the third thing for us to note in this long story, Jacob has a new name, a new power, and a new future. But he also, and this must never be forgotten, he also comes away from his encounter with God with a limp. He is, if you like, carries this limp as a sign of his own frailty. It shows that there are no untroubled victories in our struggle with this Holy One. The exclamation that God is in this place should not be made lightly, as if God was an affable friend. We should never treat God as though God was somehow a buddy of ours. God remains the one who is our creator. God remains the one whom to encounter is to encounter the deepest of mysteries. We don't come away from an encounter with such a one unmarked. So we might ponder this in the light of our own relationship with God and what we ask of God when we want God to bless us. For here in the Old Testament, the truth of God's power being manifested in weakness, and the weak God's weakness being the expression of God's power, takes us right back to the heart of the cross, where Jesus allows himself to be pushed to the very edge, to be overcome, if you like, by the powers of evil in the world. But it is in that weakness that we see God's strength. This also has implications for us as church. We who inherit Jacob's legacy, being the people of God who are to carry the story of this creating God into the future, we are the people of God called church who have that vocation in our time. So we have to learn Jacob's lesson in these post-Christendom days that God is not the object of our spirituality. God is not the object that we can pursue and gain as if it was a possession. God forever remains the subject of our spirituality, the subject of our quest to know who God is. Much later in our history, as the people of God, the church will discover again this same theology of weakness in power, and the power in weakness in the event of the cross. Now, that may sound strange and contradictory, but remember when the disciples were following Jesus and they'd been on the road together for quite some time, what was it that the disciples wanted from Jesus? "Master, when you come into your kingdom, make us the ones who will have the chief seats. Give us the positions of power." No wonder they couldn't understand a Jesus who spoke of service and self-giving and cups and crosses. This passage reminds us of what we know from the disciples themselves, that to encounter the God of Jacob and Jesus does not necessarily lead to triumph and to reconciliation and to power. It may also result in a crippling. Like many people who love the church, I struggle with the fact that the church bears the name of God and limps because of it. While we we may want a church that is powerful, influential, rich perhaps even, and effective in our society, God gives us the dubious blessing of a vocation and a proclamation. We are called to be agents of a gospel which doesn't talk about power, doesn't talk about success, doesn't talk about wealth in any sense that makes sense to our culture. No matter how earnestly we struggle for God's blessing and the desires of our efforts to have good results, God resists our insistence on a church that meets our agendas, fulfills our desires, a church that should reflect my priorities or our priorities. When we want a God who is amenable to our religious preferences and prejudices, we are making a grave mistake if we think we are representing the God of Jesus in that. There will be blessing, but will always be on God's terms, not ours. I will not let you go until you bless me. And what a blessing it became. God's blessing is so ambiguous. Instead of what I want, God gives us his ambiguous blessing. Instead of what we want in a community of people, God gives us one another, you and me. He gives us this, which is not what we choose, friends, truth be told. We would not choose everyone here to be our sister and brother, but these are who God gives us in all of our strangeness and difference. He gives us one another so that we might be Israel, God's people, the bearers in the world of the promise of God through us. So we Christians limp through the world. We limp through the world with our poor gospel, our water, our bread and wine, our struggling communities and all of our other frailties, barely believing that we are partners with God's mission in the world, hardly daring to believe that the church is evolving into a new way of embodying the gospel in community. Daring, hardly able to believe that through us, God is working God's will. Thank goodness we're coming to the end. Sometimes I'm amazed at what comes out of the preparation of a sermon. Remember that the preacher is the one who hears the sermon first. And I found this wrestling that I did with Jacob over this profoundly moving, disturbing even. Even the sermon itself is a kind of limping, a searching for meaning that never comes clear. I get scared when I see film clips of these contemporary preachers, you know, who are up there with the microphone and all of the certainty in the world and all the promises in the world of what God will deliver to you. And here we are limping and saying that the truth rests in an utterly trustworthy God and no one else. Not me, not you, not all of our cleverness, Not all of the schemes that the synod dreams up or that the resolutions that the assembly makes will save us. Because only as we limp through life with the scriptures, with a table, with a font, and with people like us, they're the things that God is working God's purposes. If every church in Melbourne, well, in Australia even, were torn down and turned into an upmarket restaurant or exclusive homes for the wealthy, even if the church in everything that the census counts disappeared, as it did in China a generation ago, there would still be people who on the Lord's Day will gather around the scriptures and read the stories and hear the words of Jesus, and there will be a few there who will interpret for those who gather, and then they will go out to do justice, to love mercy, and walk humbly with God in the service of the world's poor and broken people. And that is the Spirit of God at work. They will go into the world limping on their prayers. So, in a strange sense, I felt, as I anticipated standing here and telling you the story, that this place is Peniel. Here we have come face to face with God, and we survived. But we walk with a limp.